I had the privilege of beginning my work for CLOW 52 years ago, right in the middle of the horrible European Holocaust years. And I remember the difference of what we were doing from what the general public was doing. At that time, the Agudath Israel was maligned and isolated because we refused to simply close our eyes and go through the normal legalities and the technical red tape to try to help Jews. We felt that as Jews, we had to use the traditional method, that after all, there's pikuach nefesh, Jewish lives were at stake. And when an ambulance is about to save a life, it doesn't stop at every red light. You move ahead, you do things that are extra legal and illegal even. And for that, we were literally cursed out by the other Jewish organizations. In 1941, for example, when we were shipping food to Poland because the Jews in Warsaw and the other cities were starving for that terrible sin of ignoring the boycott proclaimed by the American Jewish Congress and other groups, our office was picketed day in, day out by the American Jewish Congress and these groups because we were people who had the chutzpah to send food to hungry Jews in Poland. But we knew very well that our job was to do whatever we could. And our view was strengthened when HaGoyim Rebbeinu Kotel Zecher Tzadik V'Kodesh Levracha came to this country. And he used to say to us that I would even prostrate myself before the Pope if I knew that I would be able to help save even the fingernail of one Jewish child. And as a result of these feelings, we undertook many things to save Jews. For example, there was a time in 1940, 1941, when one could still bring Jews out of the fires of Europe through affidavits. People who had some financial stability would sign that it's a first cousin, a close relative. And during the year, 1 year of April 1940 to April 1941, we sent over 1,300 affidavits to Jews in different countries who were just to the edge of the precipice. And we know of about 1,000 of them that came out. But how did we get these affidavits? How did we be cousins? Many of our people would sign, close their eyes, these are our cousins. I remember how Louis Septimus, Solova Sholem, signed for hundreds of Jews who we never heard of before. I want to bring them here because this person is a cousin, and I recall vividly how after the war, the FBI came to his office to visit him. How could you have hundreds of cousins? And he said that when we Jews are in danger of losing our lives, then indeed we're all cousins. We did not stop at forging passports for South America in an effort to get Jews out of that terrible, terrible fire that was Nazi Europe. We didn't stop, for example, after the war, when the Jews were liberated, and we realized that the huge Jewish relief agencies and their cumbersome manner of red tape and bureaucracy, it would take months for them to get kosher food into the DP camps, into liberated camps. So we young fellows did something daring. There was a system whereby the army was enabled mothers to send packages to their children who were serving in the army. It was called the APO, the Army Postal Service. What we did, we started off with a young man who was a member of the Agudah, and he was a sergeant. We started off and had his mother, so-called mother, send him 50 parcels. And when he received the 50 parcels and he wrote us that he distributed it about how he made Jews happy, there was a lieutenant, everyone knows his name, Lieutenant Meyer Birnbaum, whom we sent hundreds of parcels from his mother, and he distributed them. And since we were young and daring, and we always had that motif of helping save Jewish lives, there was a major in the army And this major, we sent, I recall it so vividly, over 1,000 kosher food packages from his mother. And when the trucks began to roll in with his mother's gifts, the army began to suspect that something's wrong here, that this may be a black market operation. They wanted to court-martial him. But this major had his senses about him, and he went to the chief commanding officer, was General Mark Clark. And he told him the truth, that these liberated Jews now for the first time we have to see kosher food. Their lives are in danger if they can't, now that they're free in the free world, eat kosher food. And it's a question of saving their lives. And that's, there's a Jewish organization back in America which is sending these parcels to distribute. And General Mark Clark said, fine, go ahead. But we were breaking the laws at that time. I remember, too, how there were 300 Jewish families after the war stranded in Prague. They couldn't get here. And we came up with a new gimmick. And that is, we made a fictitious convention of Agudas Israel in America. And we had very fancy papers designed, designating each of them as an official delegate to this convention of Agudas Israel. And they all came here quickly, going to a big convention. And very often during the course of the years, almost every month, I meet someone who comes up to me and says, you know, I'm one of those people whom you brought to the convention that never was. But these are the tactics of people like Agudas Israel, with Orthodox Jews who know the meaning of Hatzalah, that nothing should stand in the way of rescuing Jews. There were a number of personalities who were really heroes in those years, those horrible, horrible years when Jews were being burned and gassed in crematoria. Some of the rabbinic figures are well known. Rabbi Aaron Kotler, Zecher Tzadik V'Kodesh L'Vracha, the Mirosh Yeshiva, Rav Kalmanovitz. But very few know about other heroes. Rav Gedalia Shoah, for example, Dor Yeshiva Menayel of Masifta Torah V'Das. This man sold the shas that his in-laws had given to him upon his marriage in order to be able to have funds to contribute when Jews could be bought for ransom, money to get out of the terrible camps. And there was a time when I remember, as a young fellow then, when Rav Gedalia Shor, on a very cold Shabbos morning in the winter, walked from Williamsburg to Borough Park in order to run from Beis Medrash to Beis Medrash in Borough Park and bang on the bimah and call out to the people, Jewish lives can be saved for money, how can we sit by in silence? These were people who did heroic activities, and very few know about it. There's Rav Eliezer Silva, for example, of Cincinnati, Oliver Shalom, a man who had been a member of the Presidium of Agudas Israel for many years and of other organizations, who was so deeply involved in trying to help Jews, and he knew it all needed money, he didn't see the money forthcoming, that he mortgaged his income and salary for the coming 5 years in order to be able to provide money to the DP camps in Europe, which he visited immediately when the war was over, and in order to help the Rabbanim and Bnei Torah who came to this country to start their lives anew. And I know that when he died, he was actually penniless. He'd given away everything he possessed in life. And then you had Balabatim, laymen, who worked with great Mesiras Nefesh. You had the legendary Hatzalah hero, Rabbi Elimelech Tress, that's how there was Stephen Klein, Irving Bunim, Tairi Yidden, Zichronim Livracha. You had Louis Septimus, man of great dedication. But the bottom line was that all of them, the Rabbonim, and these Balabatim acted with one thought in mind. Jews are dying, and we just can't sit by in silence. They neglected their rabbinic work, they neglected their Torah, and they neglected their businesses. The Balabatim, sometimes weeks at end, wouldn't walk into their business because they knew that Jews had to be saved. Then I'm going to come to a story that really has been with me all this life, which I never told anyone. There's a scene that I remember right after the war that I shall never forget as long as I live. The first boat to arrive with refugees from the European concentration camps and displaced person camps was the SS Marine Flasher. And one morning, before a large group came a week or two later, one morning, as I was sitting and talking in the office of the Aguda with Rabbi Elimelech Tress, suddenly a person appears and we were frightened. He looked like a walking skeleton. There was just bones, skin, face gaunt. And he walks in and he said, "I am Bayrich Rubenson." We said, "When did you come?" He said, "Well, I came on this first boat yesterday. I wanted to go up to the Aguda." And he began to tell us his story, how he lost his wife and children in the crematoria and in the gas chambers. And then suddenly, in a very heavy voice, he began to sing a pasuk from Tehillim. Zois nechmosi b'yonyi. This is my comfort and my consolation in my hour of affliction, my hour of sorrow. Ki imroscha chiyosni, Ribbono shel Olam. It is your words that kept me alive, the holy words of the Torah. Zaydim helitzuni ad miyoid, a beautiful touching tune, I'll never forget it. Zaydim helitzuni ad miyoid, these wicked people taunted and mocked me, they wanted to make me ois mensch. But mi teiros cholainotisi, Rabbeinu Shleinam, I did not swerve from, I did not lose faith in your holy Torah. And he sang that over and over again. And suddenly he took our hands, Mike Tress's hand and my hand, and he began a rikida in the office. He began dancing around with us, singing these words with so much heart. Then tears began to flow down our cheeks. And he kept singing these words, a man who had lost everything in life. I'm so grateful. I'm alive because of my faith and my belief in God. And I remember I turned to Mr. Tress and I said to him that with such a spirit and such a ruach, these atzomus yevashis, these dry bones will come alive again. And indeed, Rabbeinu's life afterwards, he built a new family. And he was zeichet to have bonim uvnei vonim oiskim b'teiro v'mitzvahis. That dance with these words are part of my life forever.
Where did the Rav Baruch's strength come from?
He was a Breslov chassid. He was a Tayri Yid. Rav Baruch was a, I'll never forget it. He had so much faith in God. And as I say again, a man who had just arrived here, a man who was nothing. If you see the picture, just skin and bones. But his faith was so strong. And as a chassid, the first thing he did, he took us into the circle and began to dance with us. Unbelievable. I just can't forget it. Okay, now you can ask your questions. Let's say.
This picture,
my Torah desk, that first person, that's the one, that's Bayrich Rubenson. That's right, that's Bayrich Rubenson. That picture has been seen all over. I'm sure it'll be seen more and more. And in that group, that he came later on officially with the first group, there are quite a number of people who are today Askanim and builders of Torah. This was right after the war. Well, this is the first boat they were bringing. They didn't fly them in with airplanes in those days. This was about within a year after the war. About a year after, within 12 months after the war. The effect on the Sheiras HaPlate, on the survivors who came here, both in the Hasidic world and in the Litvish world, was phenomenal. It was mind-boggling. The Hasidic Rebbes who came here, and themselves when they came here were penniless. They really had nothing, they had small groups, but they took the people into their hearts. And they not only built Botei Chinuch for the children, but they also found jobs for the people. They acted as fathers and mothers would to youngsters who really had no parents. And it ended up with the rebirth of Hasidus in this country, which was hardly part of the American Jewish scene before. But at the same time, the Litvish Rosh Yeshivas made sure, in building their yeshivas, that they should give their heart over to their students and provide them not only with Torah, but with the actual basic needs. Both the Litvish Rosh Yeshivas and the Hasidic Rebbeim were foster fathers for thousands of young people. And I believe that what they accomplished in the revival and the renewal of the Sheiras HaPlate Jews is a story that still has to be written. What I would like to do, the impact of the Sheiras HaPlate of the survivors is mind-boggling. They created a spiritual revolution in this country. But we have to remember that there was a foundation already in place before they came here. Before the war, there were a number of yeshivas that had developed. B'nai Torah, Rosh Yeshiva, Jewish life, Orthodox Jewish life was flourishing in some neighborhoods. But what the Sheiras HaPlate did through their Rabbanim, through their Rebbeim, through they themselves coming from the warmth of what Europe was before the war, they totally elevated the standards of Yiddishkeit, of Torah, to a point that wasn't dreamed of before. For example, kashrus. Glatt kosher was something that only a few people observed. But under the influence of the Sheiras HaPlate and the survivors, it became a household word. And it suddenly became common usage. Chol of Yisrael was a rarity. Chol of Yisrael became popular. It is unthinkable today in a truly Orthodox home not to follow these higher standards of kashrus. And the biggest revolution was in the field of limud haTorah, of learning. I remember when I was a youngster, most of our boys, at the age of 21, left the yeshiva and went to work. 22, very few people, yechidei sgula, literally yechidei sgula individuals, remained on to try and learn more and more. And let's face it, you can be a wonderful balabas if you learned only till age 21 and have a shiur every day. But to be a real Talmud Chacham, one had to learn more. And with the coming here of the Sheiras HaPlate, suddenly the idea of Kailalim became a reality. And the thought of giving over your entire life to learning Torah, or certainly the first 10 years of your marriage, totally to be steeped in Torah, to become genuine Talmidei Chachamim, suddenly became real. And we found new levels, not only in the Kailalim, but even for the yeshivas. The boys started to learning more hours of Torah. Camps, summer camps. The chinuch programs of summer camps went up 200% because the goals were set higher. The goals were set higher by the Sheiras HaPlate. And this is miraculous because when they came here, They were shattered people, shattered. They had no money. They had no families. They came to a new country where temptation winked at them with 1,000 eyes at every street corner. And to be able to continue the old tradition, of course it was the Demus Diyuk No Shalaviyim that kept them alive, the fact that they remembered who their roots were and who their fathers and grandfathers were and their grandmothers and mothers. But it took tremendous inner strength and inner fortitude for them to overcome the temptations of America, to start building their lives anew, to increase the levels of the observance of tzniyus, of modesty. Standards really went way, way, way beyond what they were in the years before. And in this cross-fertilization that Agudas Yisrael was able to accomplish, and this was one of the important roles of Agudas Yisrael, because many of the Sheiros of Plato were members of the powerful Agudas Yisrael movement that existed in Europe. They sort of gravitated towards the American Aguda. They were able to cross-fertilize the native-born Americans with these survivors and together work on building institutions of Torah, building Jewish lives, so that today we have a real flourishing Torah community all over the country. And we have Doros, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren who are so steeped in Torah that one can say that the survivors here helped us be faithful to the sacred trust that we had from those Nebuch who went up in smoke and in fires in the concentration camps. What impressed me very much was how the Baba Rebbe, who came here also so alone to the west side of Manhattan, and I remember during the first week or so, in fact, he came to a convention of Tzvi Agudas Yisrael up in the mountains to speak to us. But he was so alone. And he surrounded himself with a number of his Hasidim who themselves were lonely people, people who had no money, people whose life seemed to have been broken completely. But slowly, these young people, when they built their families and had children, they decided that the main thing that they can do is build moistis hachino, build yeshivas from kindergarten on. And I recall the Mesiras Nefesh of parents. I know some of the Baba V'Chassidim who literally didn't eat meat all week, just Shabbos, so that they should be able to pay a few dollars for the Schar Limud for their children, because they couldn't throw the entire yoke on the Baba V'Rebbe, who was knocking himself out to the point of exhaustion. And when I saw how the young parents were giving their lives away to, in order to build a new generation that should be strong and full-blooded in its Yiddishkeit and their sense of Hasidus, I later on understood how Baba grew from literally nothing to a beautiful Hasidic empire, because the key word was Mesiras Nefesh, to really sacrifice yourself, and they were examples of that.
Attempts to influence policy in Washington during World War II?
I have a lot of that. No, at first I came in much later. Okay. And when I came in, it was at that time when we were just trying to use these false passports and these type of things, and more in the rehabilitation. That was more my job, yeah. Okay, I was talking about my involvement, that I knew it firsthand. That's what I wanted to talk about.
In the late 40s and 50s, I just want to know if you...
40s and 50s, yeah.
Agudas Yisrael's involvement in helping you build some of these moises that we just talked about, was that, I don't know exactly what Agudas Yisrael's mission was in those days.
Well, no, the mission in those days was to try to help create, as I said, this combination of forces between the native-born Americans and the survivors. The survivors alone could never have done that job, were not for the fact that native-born people, who were here for many years, were not solid partners, so that we were partners with every group. I believe that the Agudas Yisrael's main role after the war was to create that partnership between the native-born American and the survivor so that they should work as a team to help build a new Jewish America. And there is no question in my mind that without this type of partnership, without the help of those who were here for many years, the survivors never could have created what they did, and that was to change the entire American Jewish scene. I've had the privilege of attending, as an observer, every meeting of the Mo'etzes Gedolei HaTorah of Agudas Yisrael of America for the past 50 years or so. Of course, listening to these Gedolei Torah in their deliberations, I believe, made a different Jew out of me. I shall never forget those scenes. But one of the meetings that left the greatest impact on me was when a delegation of the officers, of the lay officers of Agudas Yisrael, came to the Mo'etzes Gedolei HaTorah with a question: what shall we do so that the memory of what happened during those horrible years should not be lost? And I recall how one of these balabatim who came, his name was David Klein, and he started crying to the Rabbanim and Rosh Yeshiva who were present. That's his previous generation of Gedolim. You had Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Yankov Kamenetsky, Reb Yitzchak Ruderman. You had the Blushever Rebbe. You had the Novominsky Rebbe. You had Reb Yitzchak Hutner, Zecher Tzadikim, Kedoshim Levrocha. And he began to cry and said, what will be my children and my grandchildren will not know what happened during those horrible years that we lived through. Something has to be done. And the first one to respond was the Blushever Rebbe, because I saw as he was talking, the Blushever Rebbe was already crying and sobbing. And he stood up and he said, Mayrev Rabbeisai, this man's talk has aroused thoughts in me which I'm try to get out of my mind. Of course we have to find a way, but we have to find a Jewish way of perpetuating these memories. And that Jewish way would be not just to make ceremonials of lighting candles, but to learn Mishnayos, to learn Daf Yomi, to dedicate the Daf Yomi that is learned by thousands and tens of thousands of Jews throughout the world in the memory of the Kedoshim, and above all, that the new generation should be taught Kiddush Hashem, should be taught all the acts of Kiddush Hashem that took place in the camps, where so many Jews endangered their lives just to do something that would keep them tied to their Yiddishkeit and to observance. And I consider it important that the Mo'etzes Gedolei HaTorah should adopt such a resolution, that at some time in the future, whenever possible, every method should be found that the yeshivas and Beis Yaakov schools, all schools of chinuch, should bring to the attention of their children these acts of Kiddush Hashem at the same time that they are told what happened. We should never forget what happened. And that was the resolution. And I find that while most resolutions of the Mo'etzes Gedolei HaTorah were carried out almost immediately, it took quite a number of years until this year, through the Project Ashes to Renewal, for the project to actually become alive. Everyone who has a hand in carrying out that old resolution from the previous Mo'etzes Gedolei HaTorah is performing something of great value for all future generations. This doing me personally a service, because I've lived with this terrible fear that my children and grandchildren will know nothing, what transpired. Now we are beginning to do something of great value, and I'm grateful.